And now it's, the gentleman came and spoke for us last year, and there have been several people who have asked that we have him back. And when I had the Sunday morning meeting, I had called him, and he had just had his heart attack, and he wasn't able to come, and he promised as soon as he was well, he would come back to Fremont. So it is now my pleasure to introduce a delightful man who's not really an old fart. I just had to get one in there because he had bad things to say about Irish women. Paul from San Jose.
I'm an alcoholic. The old fart from Santa Clara, right? The ugly guy. I got a face that'll chase the bulldog off a meat truck. I got a face that only a mother could love, and then only on payday. You know, I could do barumpump. Somebody go barumpump. I got to get a new doctor. I know that, because this guy, I got a hunch he's fucking me around. I really am. I went to see him last week, and he examined me. He says, you live to be 50. I said, I'm 51. He said, what'd I tell you? You know, I don't trust this guy. I don't trust him. It's really nice to come back to Fremont. I haven't been here in a while. And got a lot of friends out here. And some new friends I haven't met yet. First of all, I'd like to welcome all the new people. You're in the right spot. Take my word for it. And if you listen tonight, pay attention, listen up. If you're sober tonight and you stay here, you might not have to do some of the things that I had to do in order to get here and stay here eventually. The big book tells me that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we're like now. And that's what you're going to get. For those of you who have heard my story before, I got the same story. I only got one story, okay? I thought of spicing it up a little bit and adding something and leaving something out. I went to my sponsor, Jack Holt, got 27 years back to back. I said, Jack, why don't I just do an hour on chapter 5? And Jack said to me, you ain't no goddamn lecturer. Tell him what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now, if it says in the book, goddamn. Nice guy, my son. I'd like to welcome my two newest best friends, John over there, who's got 30 days today, or yesterday rather, and my new friend, Steve. Any guy whose name ends in S-K-I has got to be all right with me. You know what I'm talking about? Look at the size of this guy. He's big enough to stand in a manger and eat hay, you know. I love him. Typical Polish person. I love God's chosen people. Can I tell you they opened up a new Jewish discotheque in San Jose? Yeah, it's called the Let My People Go Go. I love it. What do you want? What'd you pay to get in this joint? Pay nothing. When they start charging at the door, then you can boo. It all started for me on the south side of Chicago, which is my hometown, 31st and Halsted. Anybody here from Chicago? Come on, fess up. The stigma is gone. You can tell them about it now. Who?
My
sister lives
on 42nd.
That's my neighbor. Back in the yards, yeah. In that neighborhood is predominantly Polish and Italian, Roman Catholic, Democratic. That's what we are, that neighborhood. If you ain't one of the above mentioned, you're in the wrong neighborhood. It's just that simple. You know, and my parents were people, so help me God, they were. And my mother was a practicing alcoholic. And my father was a very hardworking, frustrated, uninformed individual. And when I say uninformed, I'm talking in the ways of alcohol and alcoholism. Because in those days, there was no such thing as alcoholism. We didn't know nothing about it. My mother was not an alcoholic. In the vernacular of the neighborhood, she was a drunken slut. And it takes a lot for me to say that. And it hurts a lot for me to say that. There's a lot of pain when I talk about my mother. But it's necessary. I tell her, I've had a lot of women come up to me a lot of times and thank me for sharing the part about my mother. It's very important that I share that part of my life story about my mother. I have a brother who's 5 years my junior, and man, we were raised in terror. I heard our 10-minute speaker talk about the fact that she was abused as a child. I was physically abused. I didn't know it. Everyone in our neighborhood got their ass kicked, you know. I was sexually abused by my mother and other people. And I never gave much thought to it until I got sober and got into my fourth or fifth step. I remember one night very vividly as a kid, I had a lot of feelings. I had a lot of feelings, terror, fear, frustration, feeling less than, because my mother used to do a lot of humiliating things. She used to show up at school drunk and do little things like puke in the hallway. Just when the bell rang to change classes, there were 6,000 guys at the halls, so my mother would be over there, you know. And I'd say, come on, Ma, and I'd take her home, you know. I have a brother who's 5 years younger than I. One night we were in bed, we were sleeping in bunk beds. It was wintertime, and I was up on the top bunk, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I heard some screaming, and I was awakened, and I jumped out of bed, and I ran to where the screaming was come from, and it happened to be in the kitchen, and my mother was lying on the floor, completely naked. She had cuts all over her back and her body. My old man had just beat her with a belt buckle. He had broken her nose and knocked out her teeth. Now, keeping in mind that my mother was a former Miss St. Louis in the beauty contest when she was like 18 years old. She was a fox. She was a stone fox. And he had her hair, her beautiful, long, auburn hair in his hand. And he had a butcher knife, and he was hacking off her hair. And he says, you son of a bitch, I'll keep you home. I'll keep you home. And I got scared, you know, and I was just a kid, and I jumped on my father's back, and I said, hey, you know, lighten up, man. That's my mother, you know. And boom, and he gave me a shot, and I wound up on my ass in the corner, and I was scared, and I went back to bed, and I crawled up on top and pulled the army blanket over my head, and I cried because I was scared. It's called fear, 10-year-old kid. See, and in the morning at 5:30, when the bell rang for my old man to go to work, he went up and went to work like he did every day. And at 6 o'clock, when the saloons opened, my mother, that very next morning, dragged her broken ass out of bed and put on a house coat, an old overcoat, and a babushka, a scarf, and went out and got herself another bottle. And came home with another bottle and another uncle. See, I had a lot of uncles when I was a kid. And I couldn't understand that one. You know, I had white uncles and black uncles and Chinese uncles and all kinds of uncles. And I'm supposed to be Polish, man. I don't know any black Polish people. You know, to this day, I don't know any black Polish people. I don't know. But you talk about bewilderment, frustration, and in a spot where you don't know what the hell is happening. See, my mother got her ass kicked every day. And as a 10-year-old, I had the responsibilities of an adult in our household. Because my old man couldn't give my mom any money to take care of simple household chores like shopping and paying the milkman and those people, you know. He couldn't trust her because she would drink it. So guess who was elected? The oldest kid, right? I did all the shopping. I did all the cooking. I did all the house cleaning. I raised my brother, who was 5 at the time. I dressed him. I got him up. I made sure he went to school. And can you just imagine the feelings I had as a kid? Anger, fear, resentment. I knew what resentment was when I was 10 years old. Humiliation. I had all those feelings as a child. My old man only wanted 2 things for me: go to school, study hard, get good marks, and play ball. Because he didn't have the money to send me to college. I went to a grammar school. I tell this in jest, Our Lady of Perpetual Guilt. You know, one of those Roman Catholic, Polish Roman Catholic schools, you know. That's where my hair went. The priest and the nuns beat it off, you know. Yeah. And I later on I went to an all boys technical high school in Chicago called Tilden Technical High School. 6,000 guys, no girls, okay? And I made the football team as a sophomore, which is quite an achievement. I was a good ball player when I was a kid. and I lettered as a sophomore and a junior and a senior. In my senior year, I was honorable mention all-state and I was all-city selection. As a result of my athletic ability, in conjunction with my marks were pretty good also, I graduated in the top 25% of my class at the age of 16. I received 28 college offers to go to college to play football. I signed a letter of intent, a national letter of intent, to go to the University of Notre Dame. My old man was the proudest Polack in captivity, you understand? Because his kid was going to be in the Notre Dame backfield, you know? Well, all that happened when I was 16. The day I turned 17, August the 12th, I didn't walk, I ran down and joined the United States Marine Corps. And I did that for two reasons. Number one, the Korean thing had just popped, patriotism was in. And besides that, I had this thing called vendetta, revenge, vindictiveness. It was the first time I could get back at my papa. I know how badly he wanted me to go to school. I know how badly he wanted me to play ball. And I said, see you later, I'm gone. You understand? When I was a kid, there was always booze around the house. My old man was a drinker too, but he was not an alcoholic. He could actually control his booze. Keeping in mind that an alcoholic is a person who's lost the ability to control their drinking. My mother could not. She was a full-blown booze head. There was always booze around the house. Beer, wine, bourbon, whatever, booze, whiskey. And I was offered it. I could have it. I did not like it. I did not like the taste of it. I'd rather have a Pepsi Cola or a Big Orange or something. I started drinking when I was 15 years old out of peer pressure in school. The first time I took a drink, I got drunk. I can tell you what it was. We used to make what we call a big highball. We used to go out and get a pint of Gordon's gin and a pint of ginger ale, a quart of ginger ale. And we throw out half the ginger ale, throw the pint in and shake it up and drink it. And the first time I drank it, I got fucked up. You know what I'm saying? I got fucked up. That's right. I was an alcoholic in Gem Street, and I know that now. Every time I drank, I got in trouble. Every time I drank, I was the one that puked. I was always the one that was getting the beef, getting some kind of a humbug behind booze. Of course, we were doing a little grass in those days, but it wasn't called grass in those days. They used to call it gauge. I think there's only two people in the room that are probably hip to that. A long time ago, guys, okay? I did everything before it was fashionable, okay? My military career was quite an event. Other than the fact that I was in the second wave at Incheon when I was 17 years old, I was back in the States at the age of 19, a combat veteran. At that time, I was stationed at Marine, Kanilui Marine Air Station, Honolulu, Hawaii. All I did while I was there for the next 2 years was play football and box. I was all Marine Corps runner-up, light heavyweight champ. I used to be a pretty good duker. Booze did not cause me a problem in the military. I got drunk a few times, gotten a few humbugs, punched a few sailors out, and wound up in a brig. But then again, all Marines do that, right? That's just called being a good Marine. I got discharged at the age of 21 and came home. I married an Irish lady. In fact, both of my wives were Irish. That's what I'm talking about here. Yeah. She was a fox. She was a beautiful lady. And we were married for about 15 minutes, and she, yeah, and she became pregnant, see. Of course, in those days, I was pretty good. I'm telling you, you know, I ain't taking out no commercials now. That's a long time ago, you know, but I had all my hair and didn't have these Coca-Cola things on my nose and didn't have all of this. And she told me she was pregnant, and then I said, wow, you know, now I got to become responsible now. You know what I'm talking about? I got to learn how to make a buck because I'm not only a husband now, I'm also a father-to-be. So I looked at my assets and found out what can you do to become meaningfully employed, you know. Well, all I knew how to do was kill people, play football, and box, you know. You can get a job doing that on the south side of Chicago in a minute, but I didn't really want to get into that, you know. And then I took another look at me. Well, you're a young guy, personable, good-looking dude, and you like people, right? There's only one way for you to go, become a bartender, right? Well, I'm a lying son of a bitch. I hate people. I love booze, you know. And where else better for an alcoholic of my type at that time than Tenenbaum? So I got a job Tenenbaum, you know, and I was drinking more than I was selling, and I'm already an alcoholic, and we know that alcoholism is a disease, and it's progressive, and it only gets worse, it never gets better, and man, my behavior's getting outrageous. I mean, outrageous, you know. And meantime, my wife has the baby, and I'm becoming more irresponsible every day. I'm coming home later and later from work, and I got all these telltale signs about my person that I ain't exactly been, you know, and all that. And my old lady, you know, she didn't just fall off a pumpkin truck someplace. You know, she's a city girl. So I come home one morning, you know, all messed up, and she said to me, "Listen up, chump, got a flash for you. See, in the morning, the baby and I are history." And I copped an attitude. I said, What? She says, "You heard me. We're gone, man. You know, you're fucking up too much, man. We're gone. Ain't gonna live our lives this way." And I just, you know, "Where's your gratitude at, you dummy? I mean, look around you. This little 2.5-room apartment, those 3 pieces of furniture almost paid for. You know what I'm talking about? Got some polar sausage in the icebox, 2 cans of tuna fish in there, $6 cash money in a cookie jar. Where's your gratitude at, goddammit?" She said, "Hear me, we're gone tomorrow." I said, "I'll get some sleep." She went to sleep, I went to sleep, the bell rang, I went to work, I came straight home from work, she wasn't jiving. She was gone, man. Baby was gone, furniture was gone, tuna fish was gone, everything was gone. The only thing was left, all my clothes in one big pile and the telephone. And I got what any alcoholic or addict really needs, right? Resentment. The nerve of that month. After all I've done for that son of a bitch, you think my baby is dead, my polar sausage is split, you know. So I just dove into that alcohol, man, head first. I took one step backwards and did a 1.5 open and boom, dove right in it. And my alcoholism progressed very rapidly, and I couldn't get a job. I became unemployed and unemployable. I couldn't get a job nowhere in the south side of Chicago. And there's an expression in our neighborhood, if you ain't working, you're stealing. And I got hooked up with 2 boyhood partners of mine that I grew up with, 2 Italian kids, Frankie and Vinny, okay? Now, Vinny and I are full-blown winos, you understand? We're drinking that white port and lemon juice because that's all we could afford. And Frankie is a full-blown smack freak. He's a heroin addict. Had been since he's 14 years old. He got kicked out of school one day, square business. The nun asked him, "Frankie, who discovered America?" And he said, "Your mama." You know, I swear to God, boom, he was history. You know, but anyhow, the 3 of us get hooked up, and guess what? Frankie's got about a $50 a day Jones in those days, and that's a lot of money back in the 50s. We get us a master plan. Now we got 2 winos and a smack freak, and we get us a master plan. Yeah, we went to work for the New York Central Railroad, you know, as Gandy dancers. And the only reason we did that one is because they give you long coffee breaks. In the morning, when we used to get our coffee break, we used to go stick up Savings and Loan Association. I'm talking heavy drama. I'm talking one of these. Give me your money, and they used to give it to us. Well, this was during the advent of the SNLs, and they didn't have all the sophisticated equipment they got now. Most of them were mom and papa joints with 4 or 5 employees. Now, we make 2 joints in 3 days, and we get away with it. Let me tell you how sharp this alcoholic is. I had $58,000 cash money in my pocket. That was my cup, right? And I'm still drinking white port and lemon juice. I could have had me 15 horns and a Japanese sissy and a barrel full of scotch, and I'm still drinking white port and lemon juice, right? Now, we go back to Fort Dade to make another joint, and they know we're coming, but we don't know that. They had the joint staked out, and we walked in and said, "Hello." And I never heard so much shooting since Inchon, man. And my partner Frankie's about 2 feet to my left, and he bought it. They gave him a third eye, and he's history. And there were 2 rookie detectives, and they were as scared as me and Vinny, so we shot our way out of the joint and split. And we split up. 3 hours later, they found Vinny hiding underneath his sister's porch. Italians. You know. Yeah, you know. And they took him downtown police headquarters in Chicago, and they hung him on a door and put a cha-cha on his ass, and he told them he shot McKinley, Martin Luther King, JFK, and I was with him, you know. Yeah, and they came and got me. And that's when the story ceases to be funny. Because as a result of doing some felony behavior while under the influence of alcohol, I bought a 5 to 15 year sentence in Statesville Penitentiary in Joliet, Illinois. Now, this is the most maximum security prison in the United States. 3,200 inmates, 92% black, and the racial situation was not then what it is now. That's when I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in the Cook County Jail in Chicago when I was awaiting transfer to the penitentiary. I was in the felony tank. And it was cold in that jail, man. It was in November. I'll never forget it. And one of the screws came by and said to me, "You want to go to the meeting?" And I said, "What meeting?" He said, "There's an AA meeting in the chapel." And I said, "AA, man, what's that?" He said, "Well, they got free coffee and cigarettes." And I said, "Right on. You know, take me, you know." So they put me in shackles and they took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. In those days, they used to have death row right outside the chapel in the electric chair, because they used to barbecue human beings there. You hear what I'm saying to you? And for the, I don't know why they used to do it, but for the AA meetings, they always used to uncover the electric chair. I don't know why they did that. And I can remember very vividly shuffling into the chapel and seeing death row and seeing the chair. And I remember the coffee was hot and black and sweet, and the cigarettes were free and they were loose and they were palm oil. And I remember I kept stuffing my pockets full of these squares and drinking that coffee and thinking these AA guys had to be some kind of chump, man. Had to be some kind of a trick. Because anyone to give me all the cigarettes I could smoke and coffee I could drink had to be a fool, you understand? And besides that, don't want to hear nothing about no alcoholism, you understand? Fuck a bunch of alcoholism. I just got 5 to 15. I got 15 years to do, man. Get the fuck out of my face. You hear what I'm saying? It's called belligerent denial. That's what I have. You got a big book around here someplace? Give me that. Just give me that. That's all right. Book talks about it. Book talks about belligerent denial. That's what I had. I went away to the penitentiary. I was eligible for parole in 3.5 years. I don't make it. 4.5, I don't make it. 5.5, I don't make it. 6 years, I get cut loose. 6 years. I was talking to a guy one day out at the Llano Club East in San Jose, and he says to me, "Hey, Holmes, how much time you do?" I said, I did 6 years. He said, "I did 26. I said, "You're dumber than I am." You know, that was the end of the conversation. And 6 years is a long time, Jack, when you do 6 calendars, living in constant fear 24 hours a day and not being able to tell a single solitary soul that you're scared or uptight because you feel you wind up being somebody's old lady by morning. See, that's real. Once again, you newcomers, listen up. Because if you ain't done that one yet, you don't got to do it. Stay here. Stay sober. I had 2 stipulations on my parole. One was that I go to a halfway house for ex-convicts in Chicago's West Side called St. Leonard's House. And the other one was that I go on Anabuse. And I nutted when it came to Anabuse. I said, "What's this Anabuse shit, man?" The dude says, "You want to get out of here? You take Anabuse." I said, "I'll take anything. Let me out." I said, "Let me out." And I went to St. Leonard's House. And we had about 60 or 70 guys in this house. And there's about 15 of us alcoholics. And every morning the priest used to line us up and come by and pop that Anabuse in his hand. It was like communion, uh-huh. You know? Yeah, and the little dude behind him with the tray of orange juice, you know. But see, the book talks about alcoholics being alcohol, being cunning, baffling, and powerful. Alcoholics are pretty slick too, you know what I'm saying? Because as soon as I got my Anabuse in me, I was outside in the back in the alley, and I would lose my Anabuse, you understand? Then I'd go down, you know, and get me a big, tall dog of white pork, you understand, or a couple of them. And I'd go in the alley, and I'd be drinking that white pork, and I'd come back about 3 hours later, fucked up, singing, "Fly me to the moon, let me be." And everybody'd say, "Man, look at Taz, he's fucked up behind wine and behind Anabuse, he's going to get sick and die." But I was getting over on him, right? Wrong. Priest came up to me and says, "You're fucking with my house and everybody in it. Get out.
And I said, what? He said, get out. I said, man, it's January out there. I mean, this is Chicago. This ain't California, folks. The hawk is out. The wind. The chill factor is 70 degrees below zero, man. They got snow this deep. Women wear thermal bras. You know what I'm talking about? And I ain't getting kinky. That's the way it is. I'm talking cold, Jack. And I'm out there, man. You know. And I'm too proud to drop a dime in the phone and call any human being for some help. See, so I did what I had to do. I went to the only place I could go, man. I went to West Madison Street, Skid Row. The second most infamous Skid Row in the United States, next to the Bowery in New York. And I existed on that street for a year and a half, doing all the things that the visible alcoholic has to do to survive. I used to sell my blood 2 and 3 times a week for $5 a pint and drink it. I used to stand for hours to sing for my supper at the Sally. I used to eat out of garbage cans. If I was a nickel short for a bottle and you walked by, you're in a world of trouble because I'd jack roll you in a minute and take what you have. Because I had to have that drink, you understand? One of my partners was a former neurosurgeon from the University of Chicago, which tells you something else about alcoholism. It don't care how smart you are. He and I lived underneath the sidewalk, wrapped up in a cave, wrapped up in cardboard and newspaper, 20 degrees below zero, with bottles of wine on our hip. One night he peed in his pants and he froze to death. I went to wake him up to give him a taste of the spider I had left, and the dude was harder than a brick. He's history. You understand? But I want you to know something, see, I'm living under this sidewalk, and my partner just croaked, but I ain't no alcoholic. No, sir, I ain't no alcoholic. If I could only get a job, everything would be fine. You hear what I'm saying? I ain't powerless over alcohol. I just can't stand up. You know what I'm talking about? Can't get a job in Chicago. Because if you can't get a job in Chicago, you ain't got a pulse beat, man. That's the manufacturing capital of the world. You know? One day I took my first inventory. I didn't know what it was then, but I know what it is now. I didn't write nothing like we do in AA. But I looked down at causes and conditions way down in my innermost self, and I said, man, what the fuck? You a young dude, man. You just did 6 years in a joint, and you're living in this hole underneath the sidewalk. What is the matter with you? But I got the answer, man. It was Chicago. Yeah. Chicago's bad news, man. Uh-huh. So I took my first geographic, and I got on the bus, Gus, like it says in the song, right? And I'm drinking a little wine, you understand, on the bus. And I wake up in Lincoln, Nebraska. Ain't never been to Lincoln, Nebraska. Don't know a single soul in Lincoln, Nebraska. And if I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't go to Lincoln, Nebraska. That town's full of Seventh-day Adventists, man. Yeah. Now, my apologies to any Adventists that may be in the room, but there's some pretty strict people, man. They don't believe in nothing. Smoking, drinking. They don't even make love standing up because they don't want no one to think they're dancing. I made that up. I just made that up. Yeah. I've been drinking some wine on the bus, and I get off the bus and took about 2 steps, and I tripped over a match, fell on my face, and one of them big University of Nebraska kids policemen got me and threw me in a drunk tank with 6 drunken Sioux Indians. Them cats ain't never seen a Polack before. The only night I ever been in jail, I slept with one eye open. I thought them dudes were going to sacrifice me or violate me or something. Yeah. But they were just drunks, just like me. And in the morning, we got our kick out at 5:30 in the morning. We hit the alleys in Lincoln, Nebraska, and we're drinking that Petri red wine, you understand? Talking that talk and dropping them second alls and then Mendenhall's. And talking that talk, you understand, and drinking that wine, and talking that talk, and nodding a lot. And we did that one for about 30 days, 45 days, and I still don't know to this day why, but all of a sudden I became very depressed. This great depression set down upon me, you know, and I didn't know what happened. And so I tried that easier, softer way it talks about in the book some of us have done. I tried to go sideways. I tried to commit suicide, you understand? And what I did was I sliced my hands halfway off. You can look at these after the meeting. I'll be glad to show them to you.
No charge.
Unashamedly.
Yeah.
And I woke up in this hospital. See, suicide attempts against the law. Did you know that? True story. Anyone in here gonna hang it up? No, seriously, are you thinking seriously of hanging it up? Raise your hand. Press up. Because if you are, talk to me after the meeting, man. I'll tell you how to do it. Because if you try suicide and fail, you in deep shit. You are in trouble. Talk to me. I will tell you how to do it. Yeah. And I wake up in this hospital, and I'm in a bed, oversized crib with bars on it and leather restraints on my shoulders, and a nurse put a cigarette in my mouth and said, how are you? And I said, where am I? She said, you in the hospital. You tried to hang it up. I said, right on. And the door opened up, a little old lady walked in. Had on a black coat and a black hat with flowers on it. Looked like it had a hopper or somebody, you know. And had this briefcase under her arm. Came up to me and said, Mr. Posniak, how do you feel this morning? And I said, where'd you get that fucking hat? Yeah, only she don't laugh. She opened up the briefcase and pulled out some papers and signed them. The lady's a shrink. See, I don't know that. And the next thing you know, I'm committed. See, they pulled my jacket, found out I was an ex-convict. You understand? And I'm committed to the Lincoln State Hospital for the criminally insane. Yeah, man. Cuckoo's Nest time. Yeah, you guys see Cuckoo's Nest? That was me. It's where it visits. I'm on the inside looking out. And I ain't nuts. I'm just an alcoholic suffering from untreated alcoholism because of belligerent denial. You understand? I'm in there. I kept 17 electric shock treatments. Every kind of therapy you can think of. Hydrotherapy, psychotherapy, chemotherapy, liquid thorazine, fucked up, walking around, talking to the squirrels. What's happening, squirrel? Yeah, but I ain't no alcoholic. No, sir. Well, see what I am? See, I'm a manic depressive. I'm an anxiety neurotic. I'm a manic depressive with schizophrenic tendencies. That's what I am. You can call me anything. Don't call me an alcoholic. I bought it. I bought that label. I would be anything you wanted me to be. But don't call me an alcoholic. No, sir, because I would not be an alcoholic. I refuse to be an alcoholic. You know why? Because my mother was an alcoholic. Remember I told you before about my mom? You see, what I didn't tell you was this. That my mother died from untreated alcoholism at the age of 42. Unrecognizable at death. Beat half to death. My mother got her ass kicked every day of her adult life. And I didn't want nothing to do with that. My drunk law goes on, but I ain't going to tell you no more about it. But suffice it to say that I drank enough to get here. I drink as a practicing alcoholic because of belligerent denial and later through total indifference. Indifference means that I knew I was an alcoholic and I just don't give a shit. And that's the worst kind of an alcoholic to work with. My sponsor taught me that. I woke up underneath the pickup truck behind Babe Griffin's in San Jose, California in 1975. I just escaped from a mental institution at the VA hospital in Menlo Park. All I had on was a pair of pajama bottoms, and they were full of shit. It ain't pretty. I'm telling you like it was. And they told me if you want three hots to the cot, all you had to do was lay out in the middle of the street. Police would pick you up and take you out to the ER. Remember that, Pat? And I did that one. I laid out there drunk and a skunk. Dude came by, took me out to the ER out of that. He dragged me out for 3 days and put me in a place called the Lighthouse, which is a former recovery house. It's not there anymore on San Fernando Street across from San Jose State. And I got reintroduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. They used to take us to meetings out in the community, and I used to get up and stand up and say, my name is Paz, I'm an alcoholic, and tell my sick jokes and try to get over on the lady. But see, I never did anything like get a sponsor. I never got one of these things called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything and could care less about the steps. And of course, it was inevitable I was to drink again, and I did. To make a long story short, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous some 26 years ago. Last March 28th, I celebrated 6 years of continuous sobriety, which is the longest time I've been sober since I've been 9 years old. Two messages for you tonight. Don't do it the way I did it. And trust God, clean house, and work with others, because that's what it says in the book. Okay? When I got back here the last time, alcohol had beat me into a sense of reasonableness. You understand? I was perfectly willing to become teachable, finally. You understand? I had no choice. It was either that or die. Die an alcoholic's death. And let me tell you how alcoholics die. See, we don't die in bed with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir going, and the violins. We don't go that way, man. See, we go through DTs. We die through DTs, convulsions, drowning in our own puke, all those good things, or wipe out a whole family full of sober people on the freeway, head-on shots. We read about them every day. They don't even put them in the paper anymore. See? And I didn't want to do that one. I wanted to live. So I got back to this fellowship, and I was teachable. And I got myself a sponsor. I killed who he is. His name is Jack Holt. I can break his anonymity because he don't care. The man's got 27 years back-to-back. My grand sponsor, Al Easthouse, you guys know him. July 22nd, he's got 34 years back-to-back in this program. I love those two guys. My sponsor told me to get a big book. I didn't have any money. I stole a big book. You know a guy named Larry Tilbury? Tell him I got his book. On this program, right? Got to fess up. My sponsor told me to open it up to page 25, where it says there is a solution. The leveling of the pride. The revealing of our shortcomings to another, which the process requires for a successful consummation. That's what it says on page 25. Requires, strong word. It doesn't say, well, maybe you should think about it. Do it when you're ready. It don't say that. It says it requires it for a successful consummation. I look at page 30. John and I, my new baby John over there, got 30 days. We did this one today. Page 30. We took the step before the steps today. It says in there we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. That is the first step in recovery, period. That meant pause, looking in the mirror, looking behind them eyeballs, back there into my innermost self, and saying, man, you can't handle that shit no more. You've lost the ability to control your drinking. And that's what I had to do. Not to shine on some wife or employer or parole agent or probation officer like I've been doing all my life. The step before the steps. We got to step one. I've been powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. Had no problem with the unmanageability factor of my life. Social drinkers don't sleep under sidewalks and drink meat out of garbage cans. I had no problem with that. But powerless, never. I could never be powerless. It was contrary to everything I was taught all my life. On 31st and Halsted in Chicago, you are not powerless. You don't make it. In the Marine Corps, you're not powerless. You get thrown out. In the penitentiary, you're certainly not powerless. You wind up washing somebody's socks every morning. You hear what I'm saying? And in the streets, Pat's been there. A lot of people have been there. You can't be powerless in the streets. They'll run over you. They'll use you. They'll take everything you got. So the word powerless was foreign to me. But in the meantime, I didn't drink. And I did what was suggested. I went to a meeting for 90 days, every day for 90 days. I probably went to two or three a day for 90 days is what I did. And I grabbed a lot of shirt tails and I hung on because that was suggested. And I so suggest to you, if you're a dude, grab the shirt tails and hang on. And if you're a new lady, grab the blouses and hang on. Later on, you get your shit together. You want to do those things that consenting adults do, right on. But give yourself the time to get sober. I got to take it aside and I got to tell you a story. True story. Sunnyvale, California. Jack C. knows very well. I used to go out to noon meetings out there all the time, Fremont and Hollenbeck. And I went out there 1 week, five meetings in a row. And four out of the five meetings, the topic was relationships. Right? Now, they ain't talking about relationship with yourself or with a higher power. We're talking about these Coco's relationships, right? And the meeting opened up and some young, sweet thing raised her hand. And she said, I got to talk now. So the chairman recognized her and she went up there and she said, my name's so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, I've been clean and sober 17 days. And I was here for 3 days, man. And I met this dude.
And this dude had been here for 5 days, man. And we're in a relationship and the goddamn thing ain't working. You know, and the kids pulling her heart out, man. And I don't volunteer at meetings very, very seldom. Only when I get the spirit moves me. And I raise my hand and I says, I'm so tired of these premature relationships and this program. Whatever happened to alcohol, alcoholism, and God? Let's talk about that. Let's build that spiritual foundation first. Learn to know yourself before you try to know somebody else. Learn to love yourself before you can love somebody else. You understand? I believe that. I believe that. Most people that I know that get loaded are in these premature relationships. And I mean, I know, man. I tell my dudes, no sex for the first 6 years. Yeah. That's a good way not to get any babies, right? No, I don't tell them that. But anyhow, powerless over alcohol, I finally realized that I am powerless over alcohol, which to me means I cannot take one drink and guarantee my behavior. It's just that simple. Sober, I'm not a bad guy. You give me some of that shit, and I turn into a gorilla. You know, I went to the New Year's Eve party one time in Chicago. I came home in April. You know, just whoopee time. They told me it was a great party. I don't remember, you know. Step two, came to believe power greater myself could restore me to sanity. I took umbrage to the word sanity. I mean, I was not insane. You understand? I was not insane. They let me out of that joint. I got papers to prove I ain't nuts. But that's not what they're talking about. They're not talking about the crazy things that we did. Okay, that's not insanity. You know, you can take it's drug behavior is what it is. You get loaded, you do that shit. You can take a person who's not even an alcoholic. He's a normie, and he gets drunk once a month on Friday night, and he puts the lampshade on his head and opens his fly and says whoopee time or whatever. The guy's not an alcoholic. He's not insane. He's drugged. You understand? But the book ain't talking about that. They're talking about when we are physically sober. When we are physically sober, we still pick up that first drink. We're talking about the insanity of the first drink without thinking of what the terrific consequences might be. That's what they're talking about as far as step two is concerned, as I understand it. Power greater than myself. I had trouble with that one because I didn't want to hear about God. No, I still had a distorted concept of a higher power. My God was a gotcha God, a punishing God, a fearful God, a God that was out to get me, a God that lived up there in a cloud somewhere, hid behind a tree and watched me all the time. And every time I got an impure thought or masturbated or did something real gross like that, he'd say, gotcha, you know. Yeah, and if I coked and had enough of them gotchas on my ass, I was going to hell and shovel coal with the devil or whoever. And if I got off clean, if I slid, I was going to go up there and play the harp with Gabriel and the guys or something. I don't know, man. I didn't like that. I'd been sober for about a year, and I went to a retreat down at Asilomar, down in the Pacific Grove. See, and in fact, I just went down there last weekend, too. And let me say something to you. At that time, I'd been in California for 10 years. I'd never been on a California beach. I was in a mission in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. You understand? Didn't have time to go to the beach. Alcoholics got to take care of business. Got to hustle. Got to do what I had to do. I found myself at this retreat, and I was walking on the beach at Sillamar, and I had my pant legs rolled up, and it was a day like today, and the sky was blue, and there was a few puffy clouds, and the surf was up, and the wind was blowing, and I looked at the magnificence of this beautiful Monterey Peninsula, and it occurred to me the question, who made this? Who made this? No architect made that. No architect made that. God made this. This is the God that they're talking about. So I ran back to the lodge where my sponsor was, and we talked about the great reality that's inside each and every one of us, way down deep inside of us. And I threw away that punishing God, that gotcha God. I did that one that day, and I got myself a loving father now. I call it a friendly force for good. I call it God. A God that loves me and accepts me unconditionally now. You know, and it's pretty good. And later on, we took the third step where I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this higher power of God as I understand him. And thank God. Thank God that our founders, the people that wrote this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, this basic text of AA, put in there, God as you understand him. See, they let us believe in anything you want to believe in. If you told me I had to believe in Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or whoever, I would have gone. See you later. You didn't tell me that. You said, pick your own concept of a power greater than you and believe in that. My sponsor told me, if you don't believe in God, believe that I believe in God. I went with that one for about a year. And we did the third step, like it says in the book, out loud with another human being. Yeah, I talked to a guy last week. I said, how long have you been sober? He said, 2 years. I said, who's your sponsor? He said, God is my sponsor. I said, right on. I said, when's the last time you talked to your sponsors? I talk to him constantly. This is great. That's really good. I said, when's the last time your sponsor talked to you? And he just sort of looked at me a little weird, you know. See, God doesn't talk to me. People talk to me. God works to me through people. I have a quiet time every morning. So I talk to my Heavenly Father and I meditate every morning. God has never said to me, Paz, when you get done with this quiet time, I want you to go to 252 North 12th Street in the back, upstairs, apartment B. You'll find a drunk. Take him to a meeting. That's never happened to me. But I will conclude my quiet time in the morning, pour myself a cup of coffee, and a phone will ring. It'll be Bernadette down the central office, and she'll say, Paz, got a pencil and paper, 272 North 12th, upstairs, apartment B in the back. You find a guy with his pants full of shit, see what you can do. Not. God works through people. I believe that. Inventory time. Step 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. See you later. I ain't writing nothing. No, I ain't going to write nothing. I ain't going to reopen up that thing called a can of worms called my life and relive and re-experience all them feelings. See you later. And if I do, I ain't going to tell nobody, man, because I got some heavy shit in there. You know what I'm talking about? I've done some things that I ain't exactly proud of, and I ain't telling nobody. And I was still sober. My life kept getting worse. Sober, man. And I used to go to my sponsor. I'd say, Jack, about this job I got, man, it's driving me nuts. He said, work your fourth step. I said, I ain't talking about no step, Jack. I'm talking about my job. He said, work your fourth step. I said, Jack, this relationship I got with Joni, man, you know, that woman's weird, man. It ain't working, you know. He said, work your fourth step. I said, Jack, I'm talking about a relationship. Not, you've been sober too long. You son of a bitch, your hearing's gone. I'm talking about the old lady, and you're talking about Steph. And finally, he lost his cool. He said, you will be at my house 1 month from today with your fourth step, and you will do your fifth. And I copped an attitude. I said, where does it say in the book where the sponsor can tell his baby about it? Yeah, but I showed up. I finally did it. And I went over there, and that's when I found out what a beautiful human being my sponsor is. He's very compassionate, loving, lovable, understanding, tough love, ass-kicking specialist. Just exactly what God ordered for me. He gets my attention. I took my first step with this man. I did a good fourth. I swept in all the corners. I didn't just sweep in a circle. I did a thorough house cleaning. I got completely naked with a human being for the first time in my life, emotionally. I got completely honest with someone for the first time in my life. I told that man everything about myself, and I trust him. And that's very important when you take your fifth step. Take it with someone you can trust. So you don't hear it at the round table pizza tomorrow night. You hear what I'm talking about? Trust is very important when you're doing the fifth step. If you're listening to a fifth step, it's also your obligation to put that person back together again after he or she dumps all that shit. Don't let them walk out unglued, out of your house or wherever you are, because a lot of people have gone straight from their fifth step to a liquor store. Okay? My sponsor taught me that. I dropped a rock in my fifth step. Someone else finally knew all those weird things I had done. And it was okay. He told me it was okay. He also told me it was history and it did not have to be repeated. He told me I had a brand new start. The same night we worked 6 and 7, where we talk about character defects and shortcomings, I find out that they're synonymous. Character defects and shortcomings are the same thing. And I got character defects as long as from here to my friend over there with the beard. I had him then, and I still got him now. In step 7, I humbly asked him to remove my shortcomings. I got down on my knees and did the 7-step prayer with my sponsor. But I keep taking him back, and that's okay. Because, see, we're talking about spiritual progress, not spiritual perfection. I don't know anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous who is completely free of character defects or shortcomings. I know a lot of people that think they're free of character defects and shortcomings, you understand? But the book says we're not saints. And I don't know a saint. There ain't no saint pause. They ain't never going to be one. Steps 8 and 9, the amends steps, made a list of all people we'd harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. I had a long list. I had a long list because I had used and abused and conned and cajoled and hustled everyone I'd ever met all my life. Step 9, became willing to make amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I had to really get into some action that was very painful. The first one I had to make amends to was myself, because I'd hurt myself more than anybody else. And I made amends to myself by simply staying sober. Then I had to deal with some heavy stuff, my father. I had a lifelong resentment against my dad for what he had done to me, my brother, and my mother. And all the time I was in the penitentiary, I used to dream of ways that I was going to waste them as soon as I got out. But I had to make amends to that man. I had to clean up my side of the street in regard to our life together. So I called him, sober from San Jose. I called him in Chicago, and I said, Pop, I said, I'm sober and have been for quite a while. And I said, I want to apologize to you for whatever uncomfortability, whatever embarrassment I might have caused you in your life. And he said, fuck you, you're lying. And I was crushed, man. The last words I've ever said to my father is, I love you. And I hung up the phone. I ran to my sponsor's house. I was in tears. I said, Jack, I tried to make amends to my old man, and he wouldn't accept them. And Jack said, scratch his name off the list. You made him. He didn't accept him. That's his problem. Get on with it. The next one I had to make amends to was my mother, for all the things that I had thought about her. See, my mother died. God bless her. She died before I got off into my full-blown alcoholism. I never had a chance to do any numbers on my mother. You understand? But I wrote her a letter. Now, she's dead, and I'm writing a letter, right? And in the letter, I told her I finally understood about the disease of alcoholism that she was afflicted with and was untreated with. And I understood her behavior. And I understood the private hell that she had gone through here on earth. And I put the letter in an envelope, but I sent it to Heaven, USA. And I didn't put no stamp on it, and I dropped it in the mailbox at the post office. I don't know if anyone ever read it. It's not important if someone read it. It was important that I wrote it. You understand? If there is a heaven, my mother's there, I'll tell you that. Because she went through hell on this earth. She's looking down tonight. You know, the insidiousness of this disease that we have, that I have, okay? In spite of all the shit that I saw as a kid, I too became an alcoholic. It's insidious, this disease, man. You know? Maintenance steps, steps 10, 11, and 12. Continue to say first eliminatory wrong, promptly admitted. I can do that one now. Promptly doesn't mean 3 weeks anymore to me now. If I don't make amends now, if I'm wrong, I swear to you, I can't sleep. If I owe you an amends, I'm subject to call you at 3 in the morning and say, Pat, I'm sorry for fucking around. Good night. And you say, Who was that? You know, I had to deal with it. True story. See, step 10, I was taught you could work from the very first day you get here. See, and I like to put it this way. When I got here, I had this great big bag of shit over my shoulder. See, it's called the wreckage of my past. And we all come in here with that. And we don't get an opportunity to dump this bag of caca, you understand, until we get to step 5. In the meantime, and usually it's some time before we get to step 5, every day we get these little piles of caca, see? What step 10 allowed me to do was knock off these little piles of caca every day, because I still got this big sucker over here, right? Now, if I don't knock off these little piles of caca every day, pretty soon I got 2 big bags of caca, right? And I'm walking around, and my chances of staying clean and sober are less than average, you understand? So work step 10, right? Step 10 also tells me it's a spiritual axiom that it's no longer people, places, and things. When my head is going like this and I got a rock in my gut, I can't blame you no more. And I can't blame you. And I can't blame the weather. And I can't blame President Reagan. And I can't blame the Pope. The responsibility for my situations lie right here on top of this pointed bald head.
I am responsible. It taught me that. It also taught me about the revenge factor that I had when I was 16 years old. I can't do that one no more. Vendetta don't work anymore. Payback don't work anymore. I got to clean up my side of the action and forgive you for whatever it is you've done to me. Forgiveness, that, believe me, that's a word that was very foreign to me. Fuck me around, I'll burn your house down. You hear what I'm saying? With your mama in it? Yeah, that's the neighborhood I came from. Now, when I came here, you start talking to me about trust. The last time I trusted a dude, it cost me 5 to 15 in the penitentiary. Is that what I'm talking about? Yeah. Hell of a program. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation, improve my conscious contact with God as I understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. I've already told you I'm not a saint. The word prayer, to me, I looked it up, Webster says it's a petition to God. Or, I like to say, talking to God. Meditating, as I understand it, is listening to God. There ain't no saint talk, but I'm here to tell you right now, when the bell rings in the morning, if I'm lucky enough to open my eyes every morning, so help me God, and I don't care what the circumstances are, as soon as I pop my eyes, I'm saying Dr. Fred's prayer. Good morning, Heavenly Father. Thank you for this day of sobriety, freedom, and joy. And thank you for showing me what you would have me do and for giving me the strength, the courage, and the patience to do thy will. And that's why I'm on the way to the John to go pee-pee. I ain't even awake yet, and I got that one out. And then I go pee-pee, and now that I've been sober for a while, a friend of mine gave me one of those coffee pots with a timer on it. The coffee's ready in the morning. You know what I'm talking about? So yeah, that's not a commercial. That's a fact. Okay? And I go in there, I pour myself a coffee, and I go sit down in the chair, open up the drapes, and I look out into the courtyard, and I have my quiet time in the morning. And I always thank my Heavenly Father for that day of sobriety. And I ask Him to direct my thinking, because left to my own devices, I know I'll mess it up. And I ask Him to let Him know what His will is for me for that day. My final prayer every morning is very simple. Keep an eye on the kid. Don't let me get us into anything you can't get us out of, you know? Just that simple. Meditation, I'm getting better at. I used to get turned on every time I tried to meditate. I'd be thinking about Marilyn Monroe and all that stuff, you know. But it's getting better now. It's getting better now. You know, at nighttime, I cannot go to sleep until I say my prayers. And that's for real. That's for real. I got to hit the boards. I got to hit the boards with my knees at night, or else I can't sleep. A couple times I've forgotten. And I was so tired when I crawl into bed, I can't understand why I didn't go to sleep. I got to get out to the bed and put it down, and I got to say, hey, man, thank you for this day of survival. And see, that's how I pray. I talk to God the same way I'm talking to you. I don't come around with all this, you know, pious jazz. Because my God would say to me, hey, you're jiving me, Pops. Just be yourself, man. Don't take nothing. Go to meetings. Trust in me. Work with others. You know, that's what my God wants me to do. You know? And I thank Him for that day of sobriety. And I ask Him to bless all the brothers that I'm working with in this program, the guys that I had the privilege of sponsoring, and it is a privilege. And I ask Him to bless the brothers and sisters that are still out there in the streets killing themselves with that shit, because they're out there, kids. They're out there. What's today, Saturday? Saturday night in Fremont? Lord have mercy, them junk tanks will be loaded by morning. You hear what I'm saying? People out there killing themselves tonight. Yeah. Step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, try to carry the message of the alcoholic and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Spiritual awakening, to me, is a culmination of many spiritual experiences I have had during the time I've been sober. I told you about one spiritual experience I've had when I was down at a cinema, down at a retreat. I've had a lot of them. The most profound of which were the miracles that took place in you people. I've seen a lot of you people coming through them doors messed up. I mean, ready to do a 1.5 off the bridge. And I've watched you come in here and grab some shirt tails and some blouses and clean up your act, get a sponsor, get some direction, work the steps, and watch your life turn around. That's miraculous. To me, that's spiritual. The book tells me that no human power could relieve my alcoholism. God could and would if He was sought. The spiritual awakening is
spiritual awakening also, he taught me, and I just learned this one in my last year's sobriety, and no one taught me this, I taught me this. The futility of trying to live this life without the aid of a higher power in it. Once in a while, I get off into self-will, and every time I do, I get my head dead in my ass. And I got to go to my sponsor's house to get a headerectomy. Headerectomy. That's removing head from ass. You can actually hear the pop when it comes out of there, you know? Yeah. As long as I stay in this conscious contact with this higher power, I'm okay. When I get into stuff, if I do God's will, I'm fine. If I do God's will, it don't work. It just don't work no more. The futility of trying to live my life without God. That's what a spiritual awakening means to me. Carry the message to the alcoholic. I try. When my phone rings, I answer it. When they ask me to go someplace, I go. It's just that simple. No questions asked. The bottom line in this program, one of them is one drunk helping another drunk. We both stay sober today. Very important. Very important. Thank God for the 12th step. If it wasn't for the 12th step, I would not be here alive tonight. And I know that. There's a lot of people that drug me around drunk to meetings. Drunk and belligerent. Jim B. I used to get up and say, my name is Jim B. and I got 2,480 days. And I used to say, oh, I talk about his mama. Yeah, I just embarrassed, tear up the whole meeting. I was crazy. I wasn't docile like I am now. You know what I mean? I was just nuts. And my sponsor told me, he says, you know, sometimes sponsoring you is embarrassing. You know what I thought? Okay, good. Practice these principles in all my affairs. I don't. I try. I'm getting better. See, the program is a design for living. We don't take the steps or work the steps. We live the steps, okay? To the best of our ability, one day at a time. That's how I understand it. And I'm getting better. I'm getting better. We're talking about progress, not perfection, you know? I'm a great believer of the word heritage that applies to me in my program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you about my grand sponsor who's got 34 years coming up. My sponsor's got 27 years back to back. Al E. talks and I listen. I've had the privilege of having hundreds of hours of one-on-ones with these two men. And I'm still teachable and I thank God for that every day. I learn from these people. Al tells me that in order to stay sober, in order to attain and maintain a comfortable sobriety, comfortable in our own skin, that there's three things that I have to utilize on a daily basis. Number one is the higher power as you understand him. Secondly is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text. It's a textbook. It's to be studied and restudied and reread. It's not a novel. It's not something to be read once and put up on the shelf. I've read that thing from cover to cover probably 100 times, and every time I open it up, they slip something else in that sucker. They got people working nights on my big book. You hear what I'm saying? Of course, I am Polish, too. It's one thing to be an alcoholic. It's another thing to be a Polish alcoholic, you know. Yeah. But the last and least, it's not the least important thing, is the people, the fellowship in this program, okay? Now, once again, this is only my opinion. Like everything else I said tonight is only my opinion. I believe there's two kinds of fellowship in AA, okay? There's the general fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That means all of us. All of us throughout the world that show up at these rooms and take part in these meetings, okay? That's the fellowship of the Alcoholics Anonymous. But then I think that there's a thing called the fellowship of the Spirit that it refers to in the book, okay? And I can't help believe that those are the people that have studied this book, take the steps, live the steps, trust God, clean house, and work with others. There's people in this room right now that are into service. And I know some of them. And they're heavy in the service. And they're heavy in the working with others. I've heard it said that 10% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous do 90% of the work. And that's a statistic that I'm ashamed of. Try to get somebody on a diverter sometime. They got more excuses than you can shake a stick at. Yeah. I'm proud not to be one of those. I'm grateful not to be one of those. When my phone rings, I answer. If they ask me to go, I go. I don't want to hear about gratitude. My sponsor says, don't tell me about gratitude. Don't tell me how grateful you are, he told me. He said, show me. Don't tell me you're grateful. Show me. He taught me that. And I believe that. I passed that on to my guys. I told my guy John tonight. on the way here. He's got 30 days. Took his first step today, and his step before the steps. I said, you're going to help hundreds of men before you're all over with in this program. And I told him, he's a gorilla too. Look at the size of that sucker. I told him, I said, if I ever see you turn your back on somebody that wants help, not needs it, but somebody that wants it, and if you turn your back on him, we're both going to Good Sam Hospital to get my foot out of your ass. I told him, he got no boat. He will work with others. And I tell all my guys that because that's what my sponsor taught me. People, very important. The fellowship of the Spirit. There's two kinds of people in this world. There's people like us in rooms like this all over the world tonight. And there's those other friends that I thought I had out there prior to my coming into the program. See, the friends out there, all they give a shit about was this. As far as I was concerned, this. If you ain't got this out there, you ain't shit. See, if you look like me or this guy, and you walk into a bar and order a double, when the guy drink it real quick, and then tell him you ain't got no money, that ain't what happened to your arm. Yeah. But that's what would happen to your other arm, you know what I'm saying, if you tried that. Of course, there's a lot of foxes in here, a lot of ladies in here. You get your booze free, right? Get your drugs free. Don't have to pay for nothing, right? Until closing time, right? And then you got to pay your tax. And we know the humiliation you ladies have gone for, about had to go through to get here. And I know that. It's not very pretty. There's no such thing as a free lunch. We know that out there. That's the friends that I thought I had out there, okay? And here they don't care about that. And here they don't care about money. They don't care if you're black or white or brown or blue or green, whatever color it is, or if you're a man or woman or Polish or Italian or Mexican or Chinese. They don't care, man. All they care is, you know, you can walk through that door with your thing hanging out and your chili on your shoes and telling you stink and you're a thief and you're going to steal every goddamn thing they got, and someone's going to say, welcome, brother, sister, you're in the right spot. Sit down, have a cup of coffee, shut up. Yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous, man, it's fantastic. One drunk helping another drunk. They both stay sober today. You know? I had a woman in my life who was very important to me, Patty Moore. My late wife, Joni. Joni died 4 years ago last week. She was sober for 9 years. Very powerful lady. Helped a lot of women. Taught me an awful lot about life. If the truth be known, Joni was probably the only woman I ever loved in my whole life, because she taught me what love is. She taught me that love is giving. And she taught me that you are what you give. And there's not a day goes by when I don't ask myself in my morning quiet time, what am I going to give back to this fellowship today that's given me so much freedom? I love that woman. Love her. She's in a better spot. She went to that big meeting in the sky, and she's in a better spot today. To her, I'm very grateful. To you, I'm very grateful for asking me out here again. It's always a pleasure to come here. It's a pleasure to go anywhere and carry the message as best I can. In closing, I'm going to close with a poem that I always close with. It's nothing heavy. It's very simple. What it is, it's my life story in the form of poetry. I didn't know it until I read it. I didn't write the poem. It was written by Thelma G. in San Jose, California. I've been reading this for years at meetings. It tells my story. Maybe you can identify with it. It's entitled How It Works. It says very simply, utter confusion, misery, and pain, humiliation, remorse, and shame, dreading to face the light of the day and not wanting to hear what people would say. Like, where is your willpower? Where is your pride? They don't understand that deep down inside I wish I knew the answers to give or how to find the courage to live. I had taken the pills they told me I should. I tried all the cures, but they did no good. I made many promises and meant them too, but the compulsion to drink is stronger than you. One day a friend happened to say, I know the answer, I can show you a way. All it takes is an open mind and believe what you hear from your very own kind. So I went to a meeting, they read chapter 5.
the steps made some sense and hope was revived. I saw living proof of what faith can do. Work for them, why not for you? One day at a time, they told me to live. They said easy does it and learn to forgive. Be humble, be honest, and help when you can. And pass on what you learned to a brand new man. I heard them repeat the serenity prayer. And soon realized all my answers were there. And now when someone asks, can miracles be? May I always reply, take a look at me. Thank you all for 12-step meeting.